The granddaddy of Earth biodiversity, E.O. Wilson, speaking at the Harvard Medical School on February 16, 2006, a speech called Biodiversity and Conservation.
The rainforest, the tropical rainforest, shown here in black, covering about 6% of the Earth's land surface, down one half due to human destruction from what it was, contains, most people agree, who on their particular group, certainly it's true of ants, more than half the species of plants and animals on Earth. Of microorganisms, we don't know, but certainly of the eukaryotes. This, even for eukaryotes, big organisms, this is just this great biome type around the equator is just beginning to be explored too, particularly in the canopy, which has been unattainable, almost unattainable, for so long. Azoya, it's up there in these big high forests like this one in Borneo, up 80, 100 feet above the ground, and with the boles of the trees going up near the top before they branch, and their surfaces often spiny or slick and very hard to get up. But you have to get up there if you're going to see what's happening to most of life. The primary generator of the energy and biomass and the species that's up there. This is from about 10, 15 years ago, one of our graduate students using rope climbing to get up to the canopy. It looks dangerous, I grant you, but that's what graduate students are for. I wouldn't use that. That'd be a very bad joke. I wouldn't use it if I knew of a single serious injury. They've done extraordinarily well. So if you're into athletics, if you love rope climbing and extreme sports, and you want to become a biologist on one of the parts of the cutting edge of the science, go in to rainforest biology. In any case, we now are getting safer ways, including putting people out on the, putting them on the arms of building cranes and trundling the whole thing in. This is probably going to turn out to be the preferred method. So the investigator is suspended from the end of that arm. It can move back and forth on the arm, and the whole arm can be swung around, and you can then bring the researcher up and down. You can cover an enormous volume, you can see. Most of it previously unattainable. And here's the pilot piece in place in Panama. I, not too long ago, actually got my first ride in this. And this is the gondola. It's screened off with a door that can be opened and shut because of the Africanized bees, the so-called killer bees that are very abundant. You can't afford to bump into a nest of those and be exposed. This is like heaven to be in one of those things. You're just directing where you are to the operator far above you, and you can simply glide smoothly and silently anywhere you want, down into the canopy, around the top of it, coming in on things you want to look at closely, and stay there while observations are made or an experiment is run or tags are put on. And I really didn't. If there is an afterlife, Professor Chivian, I have chosen what I would do for eternity. Or at least, for until I got bored after the first trillion years or so. The species, the diversity in these forests really is legendary. From this canopy of Peru alone, I took, or I analyzed, and identified 42 species of ants living there in 23 genera. And that's approximately equal in size to the entire known ant fauna of the British Isles. One tree. And biologists have war stories and tales they love to tell around the campfire, actually, during field trips, actually on the screened-in porch drinking beer. They love to tell the stories of how much was found here and what's not known there and what's the best place to go and so on. And the same is true of deciduous forest. If you get microscopic or submicroscopic, it looks two-dimensional, the leaf litter, the soil of a forest around here, say, but it is actually three-dimensional, the ecosystem, when you go submicroscopic. And without going into a lot of detail, let me just say that when you do that, this cut was made, representing a piece of Central Park. And then when you start descending off the surface, going down, then over a distance of just centimeters, you are passing through one zone, microzone, to another radical microzone, which differ, these microzones differing, one from the other, in light, humidity, degree of decomposition of the litter, the nutrient, the nature of the nutrients then, and so on, the space that's available to move in, and you just go from one microfauna to the next, and microflora of bacteria to the next. It's an immensely complex world. There is, for example, in one patient British ecologist determined that in 1 square meter of English meadow, about 250,000 small creatures, invertebrates, tenth of a millimeter in length or more, 250,000. And it would be typical in a forest, especially, to have those representing hundreds of thousands of species, including new species. In a recent bioblitz, we called them, made in Central Park, or a survey, a preliminary survey before the bioblitzes, a whole new genus of millipedes was found. Of centipede. Not just a new species, but so different and distinct there in Central Park that it had to be put in a different genus. So, you can spend a lifetime studying, taking a kind of a Magellanic voyage around the base of a rotting stump and making important discoveries, literally centimeter by centimeter, depending on the scale that you're studying these tiny fragments of ecosystems, or almost in some extreme cases, entire ecosystems. And it's a lifetime calling, I'll tell you. I've never stopped doing the same thing. And I'm just throwing this up to illustrate that point. As a kid, this is the back vacant lot next to our house in Mobile, Alabama. Monitoring the insects and trying to find out all of the different kinds of ants that lived in that area. And I found, it was my first scientific discovery, I found the first fire ant colony, imported fire ant colony from Uruguay and southern Brazil, recorded in the United States. And that has since spread from Mobile in all directions, from the Carolinas to Texas, now to the West Indies, California, China, and that shows you what you can do. I have never changed. Here I am 50 years later. My colleague Bert Holdover has me scratching. This is in a public park in San Jose, Costa Rica, where I found five species of the genus I was working on, the Phaidolia, but I'm going to start boring you if I get into details like that. The rainforest is disappearing rapidly. NASA has estimated that 5% of the land surface of the Earth is burned every year, almost all by people. And you see that masses of little bright dots in this montage of satellite photographs taken by the U.S. Air Force Weather Monitoring Program. You see those all the little pinpoint lights in the Amazon and in the Congo and up into the Sahel, south of the Sahara. Those are fires, people burning grassland or cutting forest, letting it dry out and burning it. And all, in many cases, just for a year or two of nutrients in this soil before it wears out. It's very poor soil. As the area of an island or of a habitat diminishes, then the number of the sustainable number of species goes down according to what is called the quarter power law. That is, it goes down by an exponent of usually somewhere in the vicinity of 0.25. So that, and I'm oversimplifying terribly, but so that a 90% reduction in area results in about a halving, a cutting to one half of the number of species that can sustainably live in that area. And that is true of not just real islands like the West Indies I just showed you, with the West Indies with the number of frog species and the reptile species, but it's also true of habitat islands. So to give you instantly an idea of the concept of the habitat island, we just see that ponds, lakes, and river systems are islands in a sea of land. So this is one of the most general principles of ecology that has also proved one of the most useful. And the whole theory of island biogeography is based around why that is so and what the implications are of it in terms of extinction rates and replacement rates and so on. To show you how rapidly habitat, and particularly rainforests, disappear, I take the case, and it's not atypical, of the Philippine Islands. This is the extent of forest in the year 1900. It was a magnificent forest, teeming with life and a great variety of animals and plants. And I'm going to run through now to near the present time. So just keep your eye on the green, the outline of the islands, and the date. Almost gone. 22% left. But there are other places like Madagascar and the Brazilian Atlantic forest, which is down as much as 10%. And it does not take, so we're talking about down as much as half of the species that can be sustainably maintained. And take note, suppose you stopped here and you could maintain about half the species that were there before, birds, trees, whatever. But then see how easy it would be in many of these places to simply initiate a new logging operation and take out the remaining 10 or 20%. It could be done very quickly. And when you do that, you go from 50% sustainable to close to zero sustainable. That's why we're now in a high-risk situation over so much of the world in terms of causing Earth's biodiversity to plummet down overall to 50% species by the end of the century, just situations like this. A passing mention on the invasive species problem. This is the aforementioned fire ant, a real pest, I must say, and it eliminates native insect species and is a great burden on ground nesting birds and so on. You can remember what are the agents of extinction with the word hippo, you know, like animal, hippo, with the order of order of importance the first letter on. The most important cause of species extinction is habitat destruction, H, habitat destruction. Second most important, invasive species. Then P for pollution, P for overpopulation. We have to sort of slip that in because, you know, it's the root cause. I mean, I grant that, a big part of the root cause. And then O, over-harvesting. And that does eliminate species. Humanity does destroy species by totally taking it out, an entire population. I think the most spectacular case, unless a few individuals have since been found in the far North Atlantic, is one of the largest fish of the North Atlantic, the barn door skate, 6 feet across, which a skate, a ray, which was wiped out by as a bycatch of the intense fishing of the Western Atlantic. I'll go on by the horrendous brown tree snake because I just want to finish up here. Show you a gallery of the extremely endangered and the extinct. This is one of the birds of the Philippines. It's down to a single tiny population on one island in the Palawan chain. Was thought to be extinct, but now barely holding on. Pardon me. The Borneo orang, a distinct species in Sumatra, plummeting, as is the Sumatran rhino, not the rhino, the orang. The ivory-billed woodpecker, we thought we'd lost it by 1944, but apparently it is hanging on. Its history is an extraordinary epic, and the intensive search is on now, hoping to find other individuals and preferably in other environments. The golden toad of Central America, extinct. It's one of the many frog species now recently gone extinct or on the brink of extinction. The banded tree snails of the Pacific, mostly gone. Those in Hawaii, half the species are extinct and the other half are endangered. The ahinahina, one of the large numbers of plant species in oceanic islands that are endangered or extinct. Hawaii is a world epicenter of extinction for plants like this. And the birds of Hawaii, down from about 125 species, including extraordinary forms. Big goose-like birds, flightless ibises, and a Hawaiian eagle, gone. Down to 25 species, and of those, almost all are vulnerable to endangered. Now, I'm going to come to a close here, Eric. With just mentioning that we're on the job, and one of the ways of solving this problem is identifying where the greatest risk of extinction of large numbers of species is, the so-called hotspot, and making every effort to save them. We have estimated that to save the 34 hottest hotspots on the land that can be identified, and also core areas of the three remaining tropical wilderness, forest wildernesses, which are the Amazon, the Congo, and New Guinea, would cost a single payment of $28 billion. That was 4 or 5 years ago. It might be a bit more than that now. And that, in case you're thinking that's a lot of money, that's one part in 1,000 of the annual world gross product. 1,000th. It was in that time, this estimate was made, was 33 trillion. It's now 55 trillion. So and the cost may have gone up proportionally of what it would take to save what amounts to about 70% of the species, or at least put a first umbrella over 70% of the species of plants and animals on Earth. I'll then conclude, and we can pick up if seems appropriate, the whole question of how to save the creation by saying the central problem, in my opinion, is therefore how to raise the poor to an endurable quality of life while preserving as much of the original life, on which we are so dependent as possible. Because both the poor and the biological diversity are concentrated in the developing countries, the solution from the problem has to come from the recognition. This is what this center, this program, this course really is basically all about, in my opinion, or a good part of what it's about. The solution to the problem has to flow from the recognition that both depend on the other. The poor, especially the nearly 1 billion that are absolutely destitute, have very little chance to improve their lives in a devastated environment. And conversely, the natural environments, where most of this biodiversity is centered, cannot survive the press of land-hungry people who have nowhere else to go. So I hope that I have added to your thought, possibly to your conviction, shared by growing numbers of thoughtful people in all walks of life, that this is a serious problem, that it can be solved, and that the resources to do it do exist. But at the end of the day, you might say this will also be an ethical decision. It will be a test of the powers of the human mind to expand ethical thought and ethical systems. And a civilization that's able to envision God and an afterlife and to embark on the colonization of space will surely find a way to save the integrity of this magnificent planet and the life it harbors. Surely it will. Because it, well, if any ethical system devised anyway should certainly say it is the right thing to do and ennobling to our species. So I'll close then with a favorite quote of mine from the late John Sawhill, a friend until his accidental death a few years ago, president of the Nature Conservancy. He said, "A society is defined not just by what it creates, but by what it refuses to destroy." So thank you for having me here, and I'll be glad to try to take questions, whatever.
The granddaddy of Earth biodiversity, E.O. Wilson, speaking at the Harvard Medical School on February 16, 2006, a speech called Biodiversity and Conservation.